November 12, 2020, it's the Watch for Pedro show.
Monitors arrive with petition. just look like a dork. Dig this big crux. At the wholeness, it's way too big.
Watch for Pedro Show. Happy Thursday. Brother Matt in Love Grotto. A couple miles south because quit Cartito mode. But I'm not totally man alone because those engineers in Estonia with their incredible Skype invention. I got John Lister from me on board. And from, you're calling me from Chapel Hill?
I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Yeah.
Oh, it's the Chapel Hill. And now you're all loud.
Oh, sorry.
I knew that was going to happen.
All right, I'll sit back here.
No, it's just fine. I just, don't worry, John. It's glad to have you on the show. We started off with Soft Lights of Sweet Music from John Coltrane, and then Superchunk doing a version of Political Song from Mike Jackson. Can you tell me your earliest musical recollection, please, John?
Yeah. It was probably just going through my parents' records, and we didn't really have a lot of records in the house, but for some reason, my mother was an Isaac Hayes fan. And so my earliest memory of a record is that album of his called Black Moses that has the incredible gate. It's more than a gatefold. It's like it basically, when you open this album up, it forms a vision of Isaac Hayes on the cross in his sort of shamanic robe. So that's kind of my first memory of physically holding something that was musical.
But not hearing it.
No. I have no memory of hearing the record as a kid. So the first music I probably ever connected to was whatever was on AM radio at that time. So we're talking like early 70s.
And where's this, John?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia, PA, in the Mennonite farmlands. So about 35 miles northwest of Philly, but it was really, no culture whatsoever. It was very, farmlands and no music happening at all.
Well, something on the AM radio, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yep. Okay. And then.
Now, Chad in. I guess it was kind of rural.
Yeah, it okay. was.
Now this pad that you were in, was there musical instruments?
There was a piano that my dad played maybe two times that I can remember. I have no idea why this piano was in the house. And my memory of the first couple of times he played it was my mother kind of like just rolling her eyes and leaving the room. So that was really the only instrument that was around when I was a kid.
Yeah, but did you ever jump on it?
Not really. Oddly, it just for whatever reason, I didn't connect with the piano. But when I started seeing bands play on TV shows like American Bandstand or any of those shows, I always looked at the drummer, and that's when my first interest in the drums really happened, and then. My dad and my mom let me take drum lessons when I was around 10 years old.
Well, what about in grade school before that? Were you in the choir or the marching band or shit like that?
Oh, you're right. I forgot. I did play trumpet for a little bit in sixth grade, and I still have the trumpet, but it just never took off for me. I was really getting into music at that point. We're talking around like age, what, like 11 or
12?
12, I guess.
Now,
yeah.
Now, what was the first record you bought for yourself with your own money?
The first record I ever bought was this novelty song called Life is a Rock, But the Radio Rolled Me. And it was by a fabricated group, almost like the Strangeloves. And they were called Reunion. And it was this, probably like a top 20 hit record. We're talking like, I guess, 1974, maybe. And the joke of this record is that this guy who's singing it is just rattling off as many artists, musical artists, as he can in a 2 minute, 20 second pop song. And so that's the first record I ever bought.
And you said you liked watching drummers on the TV. So they get you a drum set. What kind of drum set was it?
Well, first it was the dreaded practice pad. And any young kid who plays the drums, they start with the pad and they instantly give up, which I did. I gave up for about at least a year and a half. And then
some people, like Kevin in the urinals,
mm-hmm.
We're talking paper heads. Even worse than the practice pad is the kiddie drum kit with the paper heads.
Yes, yes.
So you,
oh, my God.
You leapfrogged over that.
Right. No, I didn't actually. Now that I remember that too, I did have the paper.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's funny. You must know Darren Hill, right, from the Red Rockers?
Sure.
He has this incredible. It's probably the best vintage store I've ever set foot in. It's in Providence, and I'll give a plug for that. It's called Pop, P-O-P. Anyway, I went to his store about 3 or 4 years ago. He had a vintage edition of this very same drum kit, the paperhead drum kit I had when I was a kid, and I bought it, and it I didn't want to take it home. It lives in his store for as long as we both shall live. But after that, on my 12th birthday, which was Halloween of, what would that be? I was born in 66, 78, is that right?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe, but
my parents got me a real drum kit.
Are you aware of Surfing with the Shaw from the urinals?
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's Kevin on a fucking kiddie kit set with paper heads.
Oh,
and
my God.
And get this, Kel and John, well, they said the amplifier had two inputs. So why buy a second amp? They both plugged into the same fucking amp.
Right.
Yeah,
that's what you do.
That's Econo. That's Econo. Those guys, they are a huge inspiration to us Minutemen.
Oh, yeah.
So on this Halloween, you got a drum kit with, like, real heads.
Yes. Yeah. And it was not a brand. They were terrible drums. But they looked like real drums. So that's kind of all that really mattered to me as a 12-year-old.
Where did you practice them?
I had the greatest parents for this entire run. And I have no idea why, because my parents were not musical. I'm the only one in my family that had any sort of musical interest or acumen. They let me just practice in the house. And I practiced in the house
What part? The living room?
Basically, yeah.
Because you know about Rudy Van Gelder, right? This guy recorded John Coltrane and shit.
Yeah.
He turned his parents' pad into, like, his first recording studio. Some people are very, very encouraged by their parents.
Yeah. You and me were like that, right?
Other people, they hate their kids getting into the music. Other folks... Yeah, totally into it. So this is interesting to hear, John.
Yeah, so my neighbors, I can't thank them enough for never complaining. And we're talking a solid five or 6 years of constant drumming in a bucolic kind of country neighborhood. So I can't believe they let me.
Not as close as apartments, but close enough still here to hit the fucking hammer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's funny. I feel like my karma has come around. A guy moved in across the street from where I live right now, and he's a death metal drummer, and he's really loud, and I hear him so clear as a bell.
A lot of clicky yes, kick drum, right?
Totally, yeah. He's great, but it's so loud.
Yeah. Now, did you take lessons?
I took about 6 months of lessons on that on the pad, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And then I started playing the snare drum in junior high school. So this would have been 7th grade, and we had this really cool music teacher. This is just like a normal suburban 7th grade teacher, and he was really into Cannonball Adderley, Coltrane, which we kids didn't know about or care about. We just didn't understand that at that point in our lives. And he would give us drum beats and a drum kit to learn, and these drum beats were Mother Popcorn, Cold Sweat, and another James Brown song. I can't remember what it was, but like,
you know, he started as a drummer.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So looking back on that, I just can't believe I lucked into having a junior high drum teacher in 1980 or 79 who was into that and was able to kind of get the ball rolling for us in terms of appreciating that kind of playing.
Cannonball, John Coltrane, both saxmen for Miles Davis. I think at that time, Billy Joe Jones and Billy Higgins. And yeah, incredible. Yeah, what is that teacher's name, John?
His name was John Dakota, D-A-K-O-T-A, and sadly he died maybe 2 years later of cancer.
Oh, damn.
Yeah,
still,
yeah.
People in your life are important. I want to play something, because you play with Bob Mould, and you sent me this tune, American Crisis. So let's listen.
La puedo callar, son injusticias de siglo que todos ven aplicar. Nadie le ha puesto remedio pudiéndolo remediar. levántate, buen chullar. Un día llega de lejos, o escupe conquistador, buscando montañas de oro que el indio nunca buscó. Al indio le basta el oro que le relumbra el sol. Levántate, Curimó. Entonces corre la sangre, no sabe el indio qué hacer. Le van a quitar su tierra, la tiene que defender. El indio se cae muerto y el acuerino de pie. Levántate, Mandy. ¿A dónde se fue la uca? Perdido en el cielo azul. Y el alma de Galvarino se la llevó el viento sur. Por eso pasa llorando los cueros de su. Levántate, pues, Calcín. El indio afligido está, a la sombra de su ruca lo pueden ver lloriquear. Honoras de cinco siglos nunca se habrá de cegar. Levántate, Caipán. Arauco tiene una pena más negra que su chamar. Ya no son los españoles los que les hacen llorar. Hoy son los propios chilenos los que les quitan su pan. Levántate, Paynahuac. Ya rugen la votación, se escuchan por no dejar. Pero el quejido del indio, porque no se escuchará. Aunque resuene en la tumba, cabo de Caupolicán, levántate, güey.
Don't ever let. shadow came over me, sneaking low. And when it came over me, Carolina said no. The night was long, the nights was black, and I was lonely, Joe. And I did everything to prove it so. Everyone talks about it.
Watch for Pedro show. Yeah, Bob Mould, American Crisis. John Worster on the drums. Violeta Parra after that with Araco Tiene Una Pena. Yeah, that's a town in Chile. Yeah, and it has a penalty. A lot of hard history there. Mapuche people, I think, were indigenous. The Hellbeens over My Dead Body, a demo that just got done by them. They're from Brighton. So is Go Team. After that was Yee Yee Yamaha. Aaron Oppenheim after that was Seventh, Guided by Voices with Blue Jay House. Mike Regnetta, Carolina Lady. Now, this ain't the band from Chicago Styx. This is a proj, Alex Kwangtai and Cat from Russia, Pavel. You know, before that band in Chicago, it was a river in hell. So, and then finally, Evil versus Evil, Bob Pollard, Tommy Key. Now, Bob Pollard, people, is in the Guide by Voices. He does about 50 albums a year. You know, John, he played on New Year's, I don't know, what, 11 months ago, right? It was 100 songs. It was 5 hours. Yeah, I didn't go, but... Now, what about, like, you got the snare drum in high school, but what about after school, the garage band, basement band, bedroom band? Did you do that stuff?
Yeah, What was that?
You got real loud there. Go ahead.
How's this? You know, I would practice in that room every day along with records. You know, like, I was really into those first couple Police records, The Clash, London Calling.
So and they're you lived off records more than you did from lessons.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I did
Hurley,
take lessons.
You know George Hurley. It was two records, My Generation and Spectrum, Billy Cobham.
Yeah.
And with those two records, he taught himself drums with and headphones.
Well, and that's why I think all the great drummers, and I'm certainly putting George in my top five of all time, the guys who kind of forged their own path are the ones who I think are the most influential, creative, what have you, because they haven't really been shown what not to do.
Or they got to kind of interpret it, right, because it's just sound.
Yes, yeah. And while we're talking about George, I wanted to just bring up one particular thing of George's, which is one of the greatest drum performances ever, and it's not a flashy one. History Lesson Part 2. Every other drummer on earth would have gone to the snare drum on the chorus and not the cross stick. He does the exact opposite, and it's just... It's so beautiful. His playing on that song is just shows you what a great drummer he is by what he doesn't do.
Yeah, Georgie, he's lyrical, right? He hears his parts because I think Boone really wanted the rhythm section to come up, and he thought that was the political part of the minute. So he wanted the drums and the bass. Of course, me and Georgie were into that. Since I learned with D. Boone, we didn't have to spend much time. So most of the time when we composed, letting Georgie find his way to create little signatures and, you know, I'm saying statements.
Absolutely. And like, even a song like Beacons Through Fog, his part is super busy, but it's perfect. And it just intertwines with what you and Dee were doing so well. And that's just another example of how great he is.
That's probably the Billy Cobham part.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so much going on.
So, yeah. So what about you? With, like, you know, the bedroom band, the garage band. Did you do that?
Well, there were so few people in my area who were into the kind of music I liked, you know, which was whatever you want to call it, new wave punk rock, that I really didn't – it was hard to find anybody. But then eventually when I was 14 years old, I got in a band that was called Hair Club for Men. This was before the actual Hair Club for Men was a known quantity, the company. It was kind of new wave. We do like songs the Ramones covered. So we do Surf and Bird, Do You Want to Dance? Those sort of things. And a bunch of originals. And I was by far the youngest. I was 14. The oldest guy was, I think, 28. And, it didn't really go anywhere. We played a few shows just in like BFWs.
What was your first gig like?
My first gig was a backyard party, and that was August 21st, 1981, and the next day we all went to go see the Police, the Specials, the Go-Go's, Oingo Boingo, and the Coasters at a racetrack in Philadelphia. And for the longest time, I just, yeah, that was those were the best 2 days of my life.
Did Yeah, but yeah, what was the gig like? Not their your gig.
It was just a party. It was just like a backyard party.
It's your first. You can only have your first gig once, John.
Right.
So it's kind of a big deal.
Well, that was the first gig, and then I found out later
what
on.
What was it? Were you scared? Was it a failure? Did they throw shit? Did they like hoist you up and cheer you like a hero? I mean, what happened?
Well, it was all friends. It was all friends, and so everyone was into it. So it was a great first gig.
Okay, you got to understand, I wasn't there, so you got to use words.
Oh, okay.
Tell me.
Okay. Well, yeah, it was most of my and my brother's high school friends, and we played covers. We did a cover of the Plasmatics version of the Bobby Darin song. I can't think of what it's called. I'll think of it. But later on, I found out that my parents drove to this backyard party and sat out on the street and listened and never told me until, like, maybe months later.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
Covert.
Yes.
We're not going to say they were spying on you. But
no, I think they genuinely just wanted to see what it was about because it was so not part of their world.
Or hear what it was about, right? Because they weren't really there.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. I like this idea of support. You know, the idea of parents supporting you, that's really letting you crack like that. Drums can get a little loud.
Especially, oh, my God.
Did you use headphones?
Yes, and
that
I'll never
you
forget.
You don't know how hard you pounded, so all the other people are.
Exactly. And I'll never forget just that lightning strike of I put on this record by Graham Parker and the Rumor called Squeezing Out Sparks. And I put the headphones on, and I realized I could do just that, play along with it. And from there on, it was like the world opened up.
Yeah, kind of a click track without it being a click. Well, maybe they would use a click track. I don't know. Look, we're at the end of the first hour of November 12, 2020, edition of the Pedro Show. Special guest, John Worster. Hold tight for hour two. November 12, 2020, it's the second hour of the Watford Pedro Show.
the truth is harder than that. But there's one simple fact, and though it's hard to understand, it looks like free is not what some folks want to be. Believe it or not, it's easy, but the truth is harder than that. Don't go swallowing what the snake oil salesman tried to sell you, or any old fairy tale someone pulled from his past. Beware of people who point you towards some scapegoat enemy. Been a lot of misery all through history that's come from exactly that. Reason lies easy, yeah, but the truth is harder than that. Just a little harder than that. Takes more courage than that.
To be I'm a mean old man. I'm a mean old man. Hey there, kid, what is wrong with your head? Get the fuck out of my flower bed. Get the fuck out of that bed. I'm a mean old man. I'm a mean old man. I'm a mean old man. My food is soft, but my head is hard. Shoot your ball if it comes to my yard. I'm a mean old man.
Kids in the eyes to see what you're Johnny, not one single barmaid will cry.
Writing about my soul so the people can dig it. I'm digging, I'm digging, I'm digging, and I ain't stopping. Till I reach the point where the past and the whole world got the same symptoms. Earth's full. See, we want more. Like the Empire State, we want more.
Shone bright above.
Shall we start off the second hour with Man Meets Fish from Psychotic Norman and Sam Bennett, Believe in the Lie, Dot Wiggin Band, A Little Bit of Noise, Love at First Sight, number 7 from Dose, the Ustamente Trace album is going to have a vinyl version, Kill Rock Stars, real soon. Got a little noise over there, John. Then Falconetti with Smile, Johnny Mark and the Ricks featuring late great Frankie Onway from the Suburban Lawns. What was that drummer man's name? Chuck Roast. Yeah. Mean Old Man. Then Johnny Thug from the Thomas Scott Quintet. That's Brother Phil in Liverpool. Getting back to his piano roots. He's a bass man. Man, it's really noisy over there, John.
Huh, I'm not hearing anything here.
Yeah, well, now I can't. Now it's quiet again. Waku Kingdom with the Circle of Life, and then R.E.M. with Jesus Christ. So, from this band, well, what'd you do school-wise? Did you go to music college?
No, I barely graduated high school. I wasn't even certain I was going to be graduating until I had that diploma in my hand, just because I kind of checked out by the end of high school. I knew I wanted to kind of do music, and my parents did agree to send me to recording engineering school for 6 months. This was in May of 85, and I realized there that I liked playing a lot more than I liked being on the other side of the glass. So after that, I just kind of went into full on, I gotta be in a band that gets somewhere kind of mode. And that's where Psychotic Norman comes in, the band that you just played.
Okay. So where'd you meet these guys?
I met them through my good friends. One of the great things about my senior year of high school was that I was taken under the wing of the band The Dead Milkmen, who I know you have come across.
Near the river in Philly. It was called the Opera House or something.
And that's where we first met, you and I.
Okay.
That night.
Then it was that gig. Okay.
Yes. So Through the Dead Milkmen, I meet these guys who had this band called Psychotic Norman, who were a Philly band, and they just lost their drummer, and I was just out of I was out of high school at this point, and ended up joining this band and played some shows, made a single, and on October 22nd, I'm looking at the flyer right now, 1985, we opened for the Minutemen at the Opera House in Philly, along with the Dead Milkmen.
Yeah, it was the only time I played there. That didn't happen for very long.
No, the only other gig I remember being there was Hoosker's maybe 8 months before.
When we played with Hoosker in Philly, it was a place called Love Hall.
I was at that show, too.
And that didn't last long.
That was a great show.
That show was pretty insane.
That was amazing.
I remember D-Boot. I mean, there was cats holding up the mic like a Iwo Jima kind of thing because there was a little balcony and dudes were jumping off.
Oh, yeah.
Onto the stage. Oh, that was a great gig. And Danceteria and Chow. I think we did like 3 or 4 gigs with the Hooskers. It's a little trip. So you were at
right.
That one, too. That's great. How long were you in Psychotic Norman?
I was in there from probably just after I graduated high school in 84 until January of 86. And I'm laughing because we would practice at our bass player's house. And for whatever reason, he didn't show up at rehearsal on this one Sunday. We practiced religiously Tuesdays and Sundays, and he didn't show up at his own house for rehearsal, and I was so annoyed by it. And I came home, and my brother called, and he said this band that he knew in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was looking for a drummer.
Okay, and that's how you get to North Carolina.
Exactly, and I just thought, fuck this band. I'm going to see what this is about. And I ended up, my dad gave me like $100 or whatever to fly down to North Carolina.
Right.
And I auditioned in January of 86. And I got in. And within 3 months, we were signed to Arista Records. Just insane.
And they were, Winston-Salem's a little more west of where I know you from, you know, Chapel Hill where you are now. But wow, and to be in a signed band in just a couple months. Here, I want to play Get Famous, the Mountain Goats.
You were born for these flashing lights. You were born for these endless nights. You always knew, sooner or later, you were destined for something greater. You took notes on what you had to do to get the piece of the pie that belonged to you. You've been waiting for this ever since you were young. Be careful not to choke on your tongue. Get famous. You should be famous. I want you to be famous.
night. We won't let you do the wall again. Could you fill in the details of, first of all, what year that happened in?
I suppose it was around 2000 and 2001. I also would like to say Joe makes me sound like Superwoman, but I'm not. I'm just average woman who happens to have had an extraordinary experience. The night you're talking about, I was awakened because my head and shoulder hit the bed very hard, like I'd been dropped from about 2 feet up in the air. And I opened my eyes, and there was a gray in my face, just inches away. I actually felt his breath on my skin, and I was terrified. This is very hard to talk about sometimes, because the things that we're talking about, alien abduction. My first reaction was to turn over and get away from this thing in my face. But when I tried to do that, I realized the rest of me was still suspended in the air being held by at least two other ones. And I jerked my legs away from them and rolled over and went back to sleep. Which you think, you know, okay, so you just had this horrible experience. Why did you go back to sleep? But I found out later that kind of typical. You just go back to sleep, and they hope you don't remember what happened in the morning. However, I did. When I woke up, I remembered. I made a cup of coffee. My adult son was here. I told him what happened. I think I said I had the weirdest dream last night. I told him all that I'd seen, and he said, "Mom, those weren't aliens. Those were demons. Those were demons." And the light bulb went off in my head.
Right. Now,
how
old was your son when he was observing this?
Oh, he's an adult. He's grown very long since he moved out. I mean, he was a little boy.
Right. Okay, so he's not just a little
boy. Oh, no.
A mistaken statement. He obviously must have had a reason for saying what he did.
Well, we have a good relationship, and I think he knew that I was sorely affected by what had happened. And we are very frank with each other, so I think it occurred to him, you know, the truth of the matter occurred to him. And he told me, and it was like I so totally understood it, all of it at that point. It was terrifying. I knew enough about alien abduction to know that they were doing horrible things to me if they were taking me in my sleep at night.
How did you go about trying to focus on that aspect of it at that point after the dumping incident?
Alien abduction. I couldn't find anything on how to make it stop. Resisted, or they had gotten away, but I got really determined to make it stop, make it go away. A lot of things started going through my mind. I remembered my boy told me when he was little he had this dream about a really tall, skinny man had taken him for a walk down the street, and he had described him in pretty good detail for, you know, a little guy. Well, here it is, years and years later, and I had this experience, and now I've read enough to know that it's probably been happening to him too, and that extremely angry, alluded anger. Opened
together. Now, I bring that up only because she was a musician, meaning that dark forces that might have an agenda, and you really don't know what the half of it is.
Now, I don't have the women raped by aliens or impregnated by aliens, and then they, it's all a trick. I mean, how do you get to a woman? She can't even resist those instincts. So that's what they target.
Natalie, the bartender, said a woman got a throat cut right down here at the All Star Inn. She got a list of suspects, and the rumor mill's grinding out leads. It's like a shot of bar whiskey, it'll cost you a fin. But everybody thinks, like everybody knows, oh, they're talking lips of blue voices down at the Indian Room. It's just death or madness creeping in on old shoes. Now you can choose between the two. Just like two black crows, they sitting on some pole. The shutterbug stepped past the body on his way out to lunch, but didn't realize until he walked right back past yellow police tape. Coroner's band policemen say, we've got a body over here. And I said some mortality is biting his tongue. This Jane didn't seem to have a name. It's just death or madness creeping in on old shoes. Now you can choose between the two. Just like two black roses sitting on some pole. Well, there wasn't no murder like everybody thought. They were just a girl, the Indian girl from the halfway house. She didn't overdeed on drugs, mixed with alcohol. Detectives got the coroner's report, they're sitting on his desk. Oh, there were no knife. Funny how things do get around. It's just death or madness creeping in on old shoes. You can choose between the two. Just like two black crows, hey, sitting on some pole. It's just death or madness creeping in on old shoes. You can choose between the two. Just like two black crows, hey, sitting on some pole.
legs cast the nets. She works without on the eye like a devil when she walks away. She turns me on like a pickup truck. I like her better when she walks away. I love the sun shining through her dress. I like her better when she walks away. I love her hair in a tangled mess. I like her better when she walks away.
For Pedro Show, yeah, Get Famous from the Mountain Goats, Deep in the Woods, 66, out of Dublin, with Raped by Demon Aliens, of course, yeah. Ja Rahm, Parker Wells, out of St. Louis, bass man, multiplier, James Allen, from Pedro here, well, he lives here, I think he's from the Hill originally, Death of Segura, and then finally, Alejandro Escovedo, great music, had a band with the Kidman Brothers after Dills called Castanets. I remember I was talking to him in Austin once. I think that's where he ended up. Maybe he lives there now. But he told me he did a piece on his pop. And he was talking to me about my first opera with my pop. You know, very cool people, Alejandro.
Yep, great guy.
He was in the Nuns up in the city.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, you know about that. Okay, so how was your first big label experience?
Well, I was lucky in that I really took my music biz lumps when I was 20 years old. So it was everything you hear about, you know, when you hear like a nightmare major label story.
Jive shit, right?
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, so we had like a month of celebrating, and we're big shots, and then the rest of it was just complete shit, where we,
Well, where did we meet Mac? Where did you meet Mac and those guys? Because I think that's, besides the Opera House in Philly with Psychotic Norman, where I remember it was at Fitzgerald's in Houston.
I was not in the band yet at that point. That was still Chuck.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yes. And
that's right. Actually, maybe they were still called Chunk, too.
Might have been. Could have been.
Because they had to change their name, right? And then that guy made a band called Pipe.
Yep. Good memory, yeah.
Good memory. Not too good. you jostled so, it. Okay.
So where I met Mac, when this band that I was in, we were called The Right Profile, which is the name of a Clash song, although we were like a kind of like a roots rock band. We ended up moving to northern New Jersey for some reason, I guess to be closer to what we thought was the record business. And so I would go into town or go to Maxwell's. This is 1986.
Hoboken.
Yeah, and I would see Mac at Maxwell's. He was a student at Columbia at that point.
Right.
So that's where I first met him. And then fast forward.
And you know, in those older days before Todd, Ira booked that pad.
That's right. Yep.
People were talking about Yole Tango, Ira. Small world.
Okay. Very small world.
So at this point, Mac's not making music, right?
I think. Oh, he had a band called. He had a couple of bands. One was called the Slush Puppies, and one was called Wax with, I think, two W's. WWAX, I think it was. But then fast forward to early 1991, I moved to Chapel Hill from Winston-Salem. I quit that band that I was in, and I got a job as a window washer. And one of the window washing clients was School Kids Records, and Mac worked there. And so that's kind of where I struck up a new friendship with him. And then I got a message from my brother one day that said, hey, Mac called about something. And Mac had never called before, so I thought, I wonder if something's up. And sure enough, they were having some issues with their drummer. And they were going to go on this tour with Mudhoney and see how it went. And if it went well with him, you know, and there was no conflict, they would keep going. And if it didn't, would I want to, you know, give it a whirl? And that's what happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, again, a situation just presents itself. But you got to be there with the sticks in the air, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the second hour, November 12th, 2020, this is Juan Pito Show. Special guest, John Worcester. Hold tight for hour three. November 12th, 2020. It's the third hour of the Juan Pito Show.
Yeah.
Show, start off the third album with AC Newman, like a hitman, like a dancer. Then Wasted Space as Crane with his, he gave me 10 tapes, and here's number 9. So one more. We'll hear the whole series. Then Superchunk with Beat My Guest. Great title. So Mac needs a drummer because it doesn't work out with the tour.
Yes. And so I was...
I'm curious. Did you have to try out?
Not really, no. During that period where they were on that tour with Mudhoney, he gave me a copy of what was going to be their new record, which was their second album called No Pocky for Kitty. And so I would just go on my window washing job and listen to these songs over and over again. And so by the time they got back and realized it wasn't going to happen with the drummer anymore, I was ready. And so I just brought my drums over to his house, and we... and then Jim and Laura showed up, and I'll never forget her first words to me were, "Hey, I'm the weak link." and we played, and our first song we played was Slack Motherfucker, and it just felt right.
That was the first song you played again.
Yep.
That's a trip. Because, you know, when I, that first gig, right, I asked him if I could cover that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You guys did a great version of it.
It ended up on Live Totem Pole.
That's right. Yeah. And speaking of covers, I wanted to bring this story because it's still, I think it's really funny for us. When we were doing our record On the Mouth at West Beach, we took a day off or an afternoon off, and we all went to, was it called Mad Dog Studio?
I recorded, Flying the Flannel. Right?
What's the record Jay did?
Oh,
with you
Mr.
Guys?
Machinery Operator.
So I think it was that record. And we went over and...
Yeah, might have been. I think Flying the Flannel... God, I can't remember where that was done. It was with the guys from Boston, though, but...
Oh, Sean and Paul, right.
Sean and Paul, right. Coldery. Paul Coldery from Apache. Yeah. I think Apache, they came over. Okay.
That's it.
So, you're right.
Mad so we
dog,
go over.
It was in
we
Venice.
Go over. Yes, exactly. And so Mac played a solo on one of the songs in that record. I can't remember the name of it though.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Jay was
then,
actually the producer.
Right.
Yeah, that was the last album Firehose did. So, what about that?
And then I think the next day or thereabouts, you came to where we were recording our album, West Beach, and we just happened to be recording this version of this Adam and the Ants song called Beat My Guest.
Yeah.
And to this day, I think it's still the most takes we've ever done of a song. It took us like 6 takes to get this thing, and we were all just like, it's so embarrassed that you were there watching this.
Yeah. But, you know... Man, I heard stories that James Jamerson talk about recording with Smokey Robinson. He said, yeah, about take 239, rigor mortis started getting in the groove.
Oh.
So, you know, 6 ain't that bad there, Jeff.
Right.
What about the thing with Bob?
How did that connection happen?
Yeah, because, you know, the thing with Superchunk never ended. You're still doing that.
Right. We did kind of go on a hiatus around 2002, and we still played a show or two every year and like maybe did a song for a comp or something, but we didn't really do much until around 2010 when we started to put records out again. But but the connection with Bob Mould was I was always, you know, a giant Husker Du fan, and how did this go? I played it in Robert Pollard's first solo band, with Tommy Keen, a guy named Dave Phillips, and a bassist named Jason Narduzzi. And
we lost Tommy Keen, huh?
We did. What a great guy. And
yeah, I met him a couple of times in New York City. Nice, nice man.
I had a great road trip once. I went to see, I think it was in the same night, I drove from North Carolina to Philly to see you play at the TLA, and then I walked two blocks and saw Tommy play at J.C. Dobbs. That was a great night.
Oh, wow. J.C. Dobbs, I remember that place.
Yeah.
Pontiac Club.
Yeah.
South
Street, right.
Right. So if people know downtown Philly, that is a happening street.
Very, yes. Yeah. So I'm doing this Mountain Goats tour, and it would have been 2008, and we're playing. It's the second to last show of our tour, and we're at that Unitarian Church in Philly, and I get a call from Jason Narduzzi, and he's on the road with Bob Mould at that moment on tour, and he goes, "We're having a hard time with our drummer. Would you be able to do this upcoming European tour that we're going to do in like 4 weeks?" And amazingly, that day, this Australian tour the Mountain Goats were going to do the next week or so was canceled. And so I said, "Yeah, I think I can do that." And then he called later that night and said, "Would you be able to finish this tour, the tour we're on right now?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm feeling lucky. I have one more day of this tour, the Mountain Goats tour." So basically, the Mountain Goats played at the 9:30 club. We all drove back to Chapel Hill. They dropped me off. I showered, and then I went to the airport and flew to L.A. and learning whatever songs I didn't know, because I knew a lot of his post-Husker stuff also, but I never played any of it.
The stuff with Anton, and then later Sugar.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And so I just said, make a list of what the songs are. I'll download them and I'll learn whatever I don't know on the plane. And that's what happened.
What was his connect with you though, to get that first phone call?
We met a couple times, you know, back in the Hoosier days, nothing more than like a passing hello, et cetera. But he put a record out in, I don't know what year it was, but it was called Body of Song. And it was on a label called Yep Rock, which is based here. My ex at the time was the publicist at Yep Rock. And she and I went to a record release party that Bob had for Body of Song in D.C. And we kind of talked a little bit that night. But it was nothing super... You know,
don't know that till down the road. So that's a good lesson, people. You never know. So don't be a dick.
Exactly. Exactly.
Working with that cat.
Right. And I think it was more Jason's confidence that I could do it than anything, you know? And so I flew out there, got picked up at the airport. I think we spent the night in LA and then we drove to, what's it, Solano Beach? Where the, what's the venue there?
The Belly Up.
Yes.
It's like and Quonset Hut, yeah.
Yeah, so thankfully the previous drummer left his drums, and I got to play those, and I brought my cymbals, and we sound-checked maybe half the set, and we played that night. That was it.
Okay, that's happening. you know what I mean? Opportunity knocks, and if you're there, if you're ready for it, you know
I have been so lucky in those situations. This Nick Cave situation was just like that too.
Yeah, that's a well, I want to play this thing with the what were they called? It's Mr. Tweedy. Tupelo.
Uncle Tupelo.
Yeah. Let's play this.
Scatter along the way must be upon my face, I smile as the waves crash against the shore. As the sun beats down upon my face, I smile as the waves crash against the shore. I was on a game show. I won a vacation. All expenses paid, 7 days and 7 nights. And tonight is my 7th night, and my vacation is over. It was really wonderful meeting you here. Don't forget to write me when I'm gone. I'm heading home now, and I will think of you from time to time. And I will think of when I was on a game show, and I won a vacation.
So, yeah, also we could mention that what is the most interesting, I would say, benefit in this perspective, of this perspective in engagement with the artistic practices, what this project benefited is that it is more advanced understanding of form or formation, and especially the materialistic aspect of symbolic formation, because we're talking about memory. And so, Gal already mentioned perhaps the most interesting or most, let's say, the ambitious project up until now is the Miklós Komet's huge 500 pages, How to Think Partisan Art. And also before that, interventions of Rastko Močnik in discussing the partisan press and the role of that cultural forms in later Yugoslavian, let's say, theory and practice. So, question is, what are the materialistic effects of this symbolic partisan memory, and how these effects can be detected, and where are they? Of course, the most easy answer, because we deal with the symbolic practices of memory, which are concretizing in certain statues or artwork or films, is this subjectivity, the question of subjectivity. Objective politics or subjectivity in this Yugoslavian revolutionary politics regarding the memory has another interesting contribution, I think. It is when we start to think of Yugoslavia outside of, let's say, national liberation struggle. So what I am here trying to say is that when we start to think of Yugoslavia after 1948 up to mid-80s, we have an amazing contradictory and turbulent period, and especially it was manifesting in contradictions of self-management socialism, because self-management socialism which was meant to be a complete social ownership, collectivization of the ownership, withering away of the state, has also relapsed into some sort of financialization, of marketization of this like hybrid economy in Yugoslavia. And that generated quite a big unresolved tensions and contradictions. So if we're gonna talk about it, if we're gonna make sense of that sector of Yugoslavia, first of all we have to deal with that. With that contradiction, with that very difficult to handle question of existence of liberalism, technocratism, and doses of the private ownership in Yugoslavia, within the self-management. So how to think of revolutionary subjectivity in these conditions? And how to actualize Yugoslavia with all this baggage, with all these difficult, let's say, conditions? I mean, here I would make a little jump to the back. I like to think of this situation of Yugoslavia in comparison with communism after revolution in Soviet Union, especially with NEP, New Economic Policy, and to see in which way the artistic avant-garde and some theoretical productions were confronting the contradictions of NEP, which meant economical compromise. NEP, this is how I would like to define economical compromise in order to keep the politics, the revolution, to give the primacy to a revolutionary politics. So the compromise was happening only on the economical level. What happened during the NEP period was that subjectivity was completely pushed toward the political side, and economy was left as like objective condition. Comparing NEP to Yugoslavian self-management socialism, which of course in Yugoslavia this lasted not only 4 years but 4 decades. Heaviness of this tension was more present. But what happened during the NEP in Russian avant-garde? Presentation. Actually the most interesting avant-garde forms appeared then. That was the time when Malevich introduced or was involving with Inkuk and the Institute of Artistic Culture, where the extrinsic element that was completely kept away from the suprematist apparatus were introduced to this non-objective art, and it did not simplify the forms, but contrary, complicated and expanded to the all possible fields, from architecture, design, film, etc.
Music.
Ziga Vertov, all his films are dealing with NEP, with the contradictions of NEP. But what is very interesting, and that would be my speculative question, is the new things that happened in poetry, which actually is the most, let's say, the artistic expression unrelated to economical condition. Because if you are making a film Like, for example, in Yugoslavian case, we could deal with the blackface films and all these other expressions which are very reflecting to this, very reflecting on this contradiction. But film is a big apparatus. Film is conditioned by the economical apparatus. And as such, it is conditioned by the contradictions that are inherent in the economy. In this case, the marketization in Yugoslavia. But the poetry and such artistic expressions are existing on that subjective level where the political revolutionary form can be further developed. That in case of Soviet Union, I think best example is Left, led by Mayakovsky, Left Front of Art, and Lev Journal, which bring together the best theoreticians from formalists and the poets belonging to futurists, and coming up with a complete hybrid interesting form. And it is not a coincidence that in 1924, when Lenin died, there is none of the artists, especially belonging to these circles, who haven't written anything about Lenin. And the reason is because Lenin was the one behind new economic policy. And the contradictions of that new economy policy was unresolved. And this unresolved situation actually was very much determining of taking this, of what sides these artists were taking. So in Yugoslavia, also we have, I mean, these cases of poets, these cases of experimental poets working in 60s and 70s who have sort of built a theory of layer poetic practice through that very revolutionary form of the self-management socialism. Who is a poet lived and worked in Vojvodina, in Novi Sad, with Sarešin Tucić. Quite an interesting poet, mostly worked on the visual and concrete poetry. And now we are translating bunch of his texts that are from mid-70s until mid-80s, actually seeing in poetry a new language that can address these the most interesting, most concrete questions of regarding the potential of the Yugoslavian revolutionary project. Progress poem, complete sound kind of distillation of the Yugoslavian political language into a book called Reform Grotesque. Of course, they're playing with like yes. objective and subjective dialectics of violence, of politics, and all these economical reforms and things like that. But the first page is very interesting. We see there a partisan ready to throw the hand grenade to a mill. Memory, like usually to do with a myth, can be confronted. The liberal discourse is based on the critique that Yugoslavian socialism was exploiting the partisan myth. And I have to say, the topic that I wrote a PhD about is a black wave filmmakers also were, let's say, thinking in that terms, more or less. But here you have a very different approach. Partisan, in fact, throwing a bomb to the beat. Is a complete, let's say, separation and creating a new language out of that, what is scattered here and there in this existing like environment of self-management. So I just wanted to present this one example as like to enrich the examples from Yugoslavia. Yeah, thanks.
for Pedro Show last music for this edition, Jay Farrar with Voodoo Candle. And this is a guy who had a band with Mr. Tweedy, who I'm very grateful to. I think I was talking last episode or the one before, how he helps kind of subsidize Nels Klein do freak out music. So thank you so much, Mr. Tweedy. But this wasn't called Sun... He had a band, right? The, so, it had the guy from, in the Clock Hammer guy played drums, right? Kevin. Yeah, his name was Kevin, and it was a Nashville band, I remember. In fact, Matt, the bass man, went on to Porkchop. But let me tell the people the music. I Want a Vacation from Samuel Locke Ward, Zetachronic AMM All-Stars with, they had me on bass, Sezgin's Talk, improvised. Mangling. And Rocket from the Crypt. Oh, this coast. Carne Voodoo. Hot Snakes. And, good band. Not Rocket from the Crypts, people. That's Ohio. But this is Rocket from the Crypt. No, Rocket from the Tombs.
Tombs, yes.
That's the difference. That's the difference. Okay. Yeah, okay, okay. So, Jay, this must have been after his... what was it called? Do you not remember?
He had a band called Sunvolt.
That's it. Sunvolt.
Yeah. B-O-L-T. Yeah.
And this had Kevin that I knew, and I didn't really know. And it seemed at this time Mr. Tweedy was kind of doing like Eagles. It was much different than the Nels Klein version. But it's interesting. And you found yourself there, doing some drum work. Now you didn't have like an agent guy like looking for work for you, right? These opportunities just came.
Well, like you said, it's being in the right place at the right time. I've never had any sort of representation. It's all just being somehow in the right place when a guy comes walking in the door of a bar and says, "I'm looking for my drummer." This story is I was at a bar in New York once, and Ryan Adams comes in, and I'd met him a little bit over the years, had never played with him.
Oh, Edward said, helped him, right? Whiskey?
Whiskey Town, yes.
Whiskey Town.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Say again?
Go on. I'm sorry for interrupting you, Joe.
Oh, so this was somewhere in the 90s. I was at a bar in New York City, and Ryan Adams comes walking in and said, "Hey, I was looking for my drummer." It's like some drummer who's working with, but I can't find him. And I said, "Well, I'm a drummer." And we ended up recording like 14 songs the next day, and I ended up going on a tour with Whiskey Town a few months later, opening for John Fogerty for a summer. So it's all just like, who knows why this works out the way it does.
Well, was Edward with him then?
No, it was right after Edward and...
Because then he helped out some North Carolina people. What was it? Southern Culture on the Skids.
Yes, yes. And all the while that was happening, Ed and I and our friend Jenny had a band called Grand National.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Grand National.
Yes.
And Edward right now is in Pittsburgh. You know, a lot of people helped him out because he was going through some hard times. And he wants to make a new album.
I would love to hear that.
He wants to come to Pedro and do it at Casa Hanzo. And I told him, man, I'll help him out. I'll do the bass, no problem. And he says, thank you. Thank you, Michael. So
that's awesome.
That's his next plan. Yeah, it's really good news. I see him all the time when I come through. But, man, when I heard that bad news about it, he had some hematoma, you know, some blood clot in his legs and stuff. But they took care of that, and he's on his road to recovery. So with Jay Farrar or the Nick Cave, you said something about Nick Cave, an opportunity?
Yes. I don't know how many years ago this was. Maybe it was 3 years ago. I get a message from Fred Armisen. About playing in this.
Are you talking? You're talking about the comedian.
Yes. Yeah.
But he was on my show once, and he told me he was a drummer.
Oh yeah, he's a great drummer. Like he's really good at that kind of technical stuff. It's really impressive.
The Chicago guy, right? And he was in some bands. He was telling us.
Yeah.
Me and Brother
Matt. So he and this guy Bill Hader, who was a Saturday Night Live guy also.
Excuse me, but we're going to get to this. But you have a comedy connection. Is that how you knew Fred, or was it through music?
I think with Fred, it was through music, because he would come and pop on stage for a song or two with Bob Mould over the years. Yeah. So he'd play guitar, would do Flip Your Wig or something.
He connects you with, great album. He connects you with Nick Cave.
Yes. So basically, Fred and Bill have this show called Documentary Now, and it's... They do these really great spoofs of actual documentaries. So they were doing this spoof of the Talking Heads documentary, Stop Making Sense. And he asked if I would be the drummer.
Is that the big outfit?
Exactly, yeah. Yes. So he asked if I would be the drummer in this band. And so I go out to L.A. and we rehearse. And it's super fun. And we shoot the episode. And basically it's set up the exact way the actual film is, where it's a concert and it all takes place in one theater and, you know, over this night. And everything changes as the show goes along. And we shoot the whole show twice. And in between the first and second tapings, one of the actors in the episode is this guy, Hal Wilner, the great music supervisor.
Oh, we just lost him, right?
Yes, yes. And so Hal comes up and says, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, I was going to fly home." And he goes, "Would you stay an extra day?" And I go, "Yeah, why?" And he said, "I'm producing this session tomorrow at Village Recorder." And I said, "Who is it?" And he goes, it's this T-Rex Mark Bolan tribute album I'm producing. And it's Nick Cave.
You're talking about Village Recorder in Santa Monica.
Yes, yes.
That's where the Dan recorded.
Right, same room. That same room.
I've been in there.
Yeah. And so I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do it." And so we record the whole next take of the whole show. But during the entire show, I'm just thinking, all right, I got to learn these songs. I gotta find somewhere to stay. I gotta see if I can get this rental car for an extra day. So it was the most, like, on autopilot I've ever been playing, but in a good way. Like, I was playing, and so...
Cosmic Dancer from Electric Warrior.
Yes, yeah.
You know, me and D. Boone's first concert we saw together was T-Rex.
That's amazing. At the Civic Center, or
it was the Long Beach Auditorium. It's torn down now. Now there's the Long Beach Opera House where it used to be. But all the in concerts, a lot of them were filmed there.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay, that's cool.
That's why you're on the show, John, so you can find out like that. So yeah, because that's a trippy song. I don't even remember. Yeah, the drums come in, they lay out, and then they come in for the insignificant things.
Yes, exactly. Very, very kind of sporadic and kind of soft.
I think it was Tony Visconti, and they've got Flo and Eddie. And
mm-hmm.
So you guys, did Nick play piano?
Yes, yeah. So I showed up the next day, kind of still disbelieving this thing was going to happen. And I get in there, and there's a film crew there, and... Second or so later, he walks in. It's like, oh my God, that's him. He's here. And we.
Big forehead. He's got a big forehead.
Oh my God. Yeah. Doesn't look like anyone else. He's just like, he's just his own thing. It's so cool. And so he played the piano and we all just kind of fell into our little parts and.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you don't want to do exactly like the original. You want to reinterpret it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, it was still.
I think he's the only guy left in T-Rex alive is the drummer man, Will Legend.
Might be. I think you're right. I think you're right.
You know, we got it. Only like 5 more minutes of the show, but I gotta tell people about we alluded to the comedy thing with Fred, but how'd that happen? I mean, that's another part of your artistic expression.
Yeah, I feel like when I'm dead and gone, the thing I want to be most remembered for is this giant box set that Tom Sharpling and I put out about 5 years ago or so. We have been doing this radio show for, God, it feels like it's 30 years, but I think it's been 15 or so, where I'll call in as these fake characters and we perform these very long form comedy pieces. And, but the way I got into that was kind of the way all these musical connections happen, just like right place, right time, and without much thought going into it. I never had any comedy aspirations in
full time. Yeah, because think about it, John, like the way you learn drums, you got these records or Georgie, you know. Now, did you buy like some George Carlin and Lenny Bruce albums?
No. When I was a kid, I my brother and I would listen to he cannot be named anymore, Bill Cosby, those records, and those were Those were hugely influential records for me as like a 6-year-old or something. But I loved Second City Television. That's probably my favorite thing that I liked. Mr. Show was a great show in the 90s.
Yeah,
things like that.
Was really strange. It was hard to tell if it was on. You know what I'm talking about? Like the fourth wall kind of thing.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
So you were kind of being influenced by this stuff without really trying. It was just you were absorbing it. But then you, what's your partner's name?
Tom Sharpling.
Tom. So how'd you meet Tom? Because he's probably instrumental, right?
Oh, yeah. We met at this crazy power bill of an indie rock show. It was at this very short-lived New York venue called, I think... It wasn't the original Ritz. It was the second Ritz, and basically it was Studio 54, but with a new name. So we're talking 1993 or two.
You know the Ritz is back. It's called Webster Hall now.
Yes, yeah. Wasn't the Academy?
So how did you meet him? It was a power bill.
It was My Bloody Valentine, Superchunk, and Pavement, and that's where I met Tom. He came to the show. He was friends with the guys in Superchunk before I was in the band. And we just hit it off that night about comedy and music. And we just ended up talking on the phone every day for about probably 3 years or so before we did our first ever call on his show on WFMU. And that's when we really started doing the calls regularly.
Whoa. Wow. So again, you know, it's a man with the beat in his hand. You're there.
Right.
You're prepared. You were prepared. Where can people find you on the internet, John?
I am at John Worster, JONWURSTER, on all of them, on Instagram, Twitter, and...
No, but do you have your own website?
I don't, no.
Shame on you. It's like having your own fanzines.
It's
so
true.
So you're putting your flyers on everybody else's telephone poles, but one day you'll get your own website, and then you'll have
right.
Nobody like being middleman on your message. Okay.
That's right.
But and what about and tell people about this show, because people, you can listen to WFMU on the internet, and so when is this show?
Well,
or is it on demand? Can you listen to it anytime?
Absolutely. We're no longer on WFMU. It's a standalone thing, and you can find it at thebestshow.net.
Okay.
Thebestshow.net.
Okay. And
yeah.
You'd be able to hear Tom and John yuck it up. Do you still call in? Is it still the same MO?
Yes. We had our first call. We had like a 6-month sabbatical after all this stuff happened, and We came back strong Tuesday night,
okay.
So we're back. Oh, and I wanted to tell you this.
Bring it.
Tom also is a really great writer. He was a co-producer writer on that TV show Monk. And after he got done with Monk, he wrote this new kind of funny detective show. It never got picked up, but the name of the show and the titular character's name was Mike Watts, WATTS, and that was a tribute to you.
Whoa.
Yes.
Yeah, that's when there's more than one of us. Tell Tom thank you very much.
I will.
And it's been most kind of you being on the show, really, John. And any kind of music you got, come bring it. We'll talk about it. You're just righteous inspiration for anyone creative. Thank you so much for being you.
Mike, I wanted to tell you one more thing.
Bring it.
I don't want to embarrass you or me, but when I was in this very, very dark patch between the band that got signed to Arista and Superchunk, I had more than a handful of dreams in which you were there and were very helpful to me. So I don't know what that meant, but... I've always appreciated it.
I'm glad I was there to aid and abet in your journey, because it's righteous.
You did.
People, it's been November 12th, 2020 edition of Watt Peter, so keep your powder dry.